As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Paul Sweeney. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
Anastasia Amoroso joins us right now. She's the Chief Investment Strategist for iCapital. Anastasia, we've got a little bit of a drawdown here, 5%, give or take a little bit. Is this a buying opportunity? Is this a buying on the dip opportunity? Or do you think there's more correction to go in this market as a market discounts? Maybe a Fed that's going to be a little bit less dovish than we initially thought.
Yeah, well, good morning, Paul and Tom. And I do think this is a buying opportunity. You want to buy this dip, but I would say you want to buy it gradually. And the reason I say that is because when you look at the technical setup now versus where we were in the beginning of April, it is much, much cleaner on certain measures. For example, bears are back, relative to where they were to start the year. You also had a correction from overbought levels to now near oversold levels. You have stocks that are actually trading at 1 month lows. And so all of those indicators suggest that we have a much cleaner technical positions. But there is a but from the perspective that we have traded down below some of the key moving average levels. We have traded down below some of the key thresholds for some of the systematic investors. So if we do continue to get this cocktail of uncertainty from geopolitics and the Fed and the macro, I could see some more selling pressure on these markets. Now, I do think it ultimately resolves, because the reason why we say investors should step in, because many investors are sitting on 20 or 30% cash that they need to put back to work just to get back to their strategic allocations. So I think as those investors step in, as the buybacks come back into play, and frankly, as we get better news flow, I do think the market can pick back up from here. So I would buy this dip, but we just do that gradually.
Anastasia, since we've many of our listeners, investors, all they've ever known is technology leading the stock market. Should we be looking at tech on this dip here, or are there some other sectors that you think might have better risk reward opportunities?
It's tech and other sectors. And, I think I'm always going to like buying tech on the dip because tech is where the growth is. And that's what really drives most of the earnings growth. And so if you look at semiconductors, for example, they were in a stellar run, but they have corrected some. But at the same time, I actually expect this year is going to be a growth year in terms of revenues for the semiconductor industry. So it's not just about multiple expansion. So I do like that. I would buy semiconductors on a dip. But looking outside of tech, Tom, I would look to some of the cyclicals like industrials, materials, and of course, energy, because the big thing that I feel like is not very well talked about is this uptick in global manufacturing that is starting.
Yeah. Anastasia, you got a basic idea of a better nominal GDP, inflation up a little bit, GDP up a little bit, at least not the doom and gloom that everybody was predicting. Do we have any knowledge of what the revenue dynamics are going to be sector to sector? To me, the great miss is they may come in better than good.
Yeah, I think they just might, Tom. I mean, going into this quarter's reporting season, the bar has actually been reset lower. You had a lot of companies that issued negative guidance, which I actually view as a positive because it means it's out there. It's all about what's already priced in. We also had a downwards revision for the first quarter earnings, which again means companies may actually be able to beat that. But as I look, you know, broader, and I look at the number of earnings revisions upgrades for this year versus downgrades, the upgrades actually outpace the downgrades for the United States this year and next year. So I think there is a positive story. And, you know, the reason why I think cyclicals are an interesting place to position is because clearly their earnings have lagged the technology sector. But if you do have this broadening out of manufacturing activity, I think things like things beyond semiconductors can experience an upwards earnings revision cycle.
Anastasia Amoroso, thank you so much for iCapital.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I'm explaining this as clearly as I can in as short a time so as to not waste any time. We need to hear from Lakshman Hachathon. And that is that there's a way to do economics where you look at series, lines on a graph, and you try to extrapolate out or guess out short-term, medium-term, and long-term. Long ago and far away, before Alan Greenspan, I should say, was a guy named Geoffrey Moore. In fact, Geoffrey Moore's student was Alan Greenspan. And this owes very much to the work of Ed Hyman, who was in here this week with C.J. Lawrence years ago. You got to look at the data. You have to look at the cycles. And here's the key phrase of business. Carrying this heritage forward with leading indicators from the Economic Cycle Research Institute, Lakshman Hachathon. An honor to have you in here, Lakshman. I can't imagine just, you know, the pandemic and coming out of it's been like. Can you do cycle research given a health event like a pandemic and given the massive three stimuli we've seen from the federal government?
Sure, absolutely. The critical component is the inflection point in the cycle. So the premise, going way back, and thank you for going back, Dr. Moore, who was Greenspan's teacher, his teacher was a man named Wesley Mitchell, who defined what a cycle was, what a business cycle is. So we use these phrases around a lot now, but 100 years ago,
is original.
They didn't know what it was. And so we have this ebb and flow, the upswing and the downswing in free market-oriented economies. Look, it's the best way to organize an economy.
Right.
The Achilles heel is it has a cycle. So when you approach these turning points, what's the best tool to understand the risk? And we have found, and this is over three generations now, so we've been testing this, that a leading indicator approach where it kind of flags the risk of a turn is a good complement to the econometric model approach, which is really good in between the turn.
And the key thing there that's religion, folks, in the business of not losing money is a good complement. Did you catch the higher economic growth of the last three, four, five quarters?
Well, first and foremost, in 2020, we said it was going to be a short, nasty recession, and then we would be off to the races. So it's hard to remember, but there was a lot of hand-wringing in 2020 and 2021, and we were looking straight up. Now, the cycle indicators turned down sharply. So in 22 into 23, the cyclical impulse was very much to the downside. We actually had two negative quarters of GDP, but that's not a recession. I'm sorry. You have to have negative jobs growth. And so we did not have a recession in 22, 23, even though the cycle indicators came down hard. The reason is, as Tom just alluded, this backwash of COVID. There's two key pieces that we're dealing with even today. The backwash is still here. One is that you have a huge constraint, a generational constraint on the labor market. So under the Trump administration, you had about 4 years of very low, if nothing, on legal immigration. That knocks out several million people from the labor force. Post-COVID, a lot of people didn't come back. That knocks out millions more. On top of a highly constrained labor market, we put $7 trillion. Remember Senator Dirksen? He used to say a billion here, a billion there, that's a lot of money. Now we're talking trillions here and trillions there on top of a tight labor market. Very hard for jobs to go negative. Very, so much foam on the runway, hard to have a recession. Now, let's get to today. Leading indicators are actually firming on growth. They're starting to actually firm a bit. And the other thing I want to get on the table is there's a global industrial upturn that's not country specific. That's around the world. The manufacturing floors are getting a grip. And then separate cycles, because you alluded to Greenspan, there's an inflation cycle we have to contend to. No, it's different than growth, and that's moving up.
So, I mean, again, that is probably one of the key issues for this Federal Reserve, as they think about inflation. How does inflation factor into this, and is there a reasonable scenario where this Fed doesn't have to cut rates?
Yeah. The short answer is yes, okay? So we use these, there's the target, which is CPI inflation or PCE deflator or all these things, and they define the cycle, and we can say there was upswings and downswings. We're in a downswing for the most part. But there's a lot of signs that some of the coincident data is bottoming. And the reason I'm suspicious about that is because of the leading indicators of inflation. Internationally, they've turned up. In the U.S., we're the one holdout where instead of turning up, our future inflation gauge has been flat for over a year. So we really were prepared for the sticky or higher for longer or whatever has been going on. And now, with the knowledge that international inflation cycles are largely synchronized, we're really suspicious that the U.S. could go up.
I'm going to go away from you and go to lines on the chart and all that.
Yeah.
My chart of the year right now is a yield to worst global aggregate index. I'm stealing this from someone, folks. Mm-hmm. I'll cite him next Monday. But the answer is I'm out four standard deviations from the Volcker disinflation out to the where we are now, which is 4.00% yield on a global basis. To me, that's reversion to the mean. Does Lajmanajathan and ECRI believe in reversion to the mean?
Yeah, it'd be nice, but it keeps going. That's the thing. So we have cycles, and they don't know about means, right? They're cycling up and they're cycling
down. I busted his chops. He knows I'm doing it. Show this. Come on, Michael. Stay with me here.
And
you don't believe in reversion to the mean.
No, it's going to turn. I mean, I think if there's a headline here, it's that inflation is cyclical. Sometimes people forget that. It doesn't go down to your target and hang out there. It likes to bottom and turn up and peak and turn down. And the Fed has been learning this very difficult lesson since 2018. They've been learning this. And I don't think they've really gotten the lesson quite yet. Maybe here, I mean, how many pivots have there been for Powell now? There's been a few.
Yep.
We're very transitory.
Yep.
Transitory is like anathema to Geoffrey Moore.
Exactly.
Just so you know.
All right, so it's interesting here. We look at this economy.
Yeah.
I think, have we taken recession completely off the table here?
So when I talk about cycles, I'm looking at a couple quarters.
Okay.
So what happens after that, I think, is yet to be determined, quite frankly. What really happens, the way you get a recession, is the cyclical impulse moves to the downside, window of vulnerability opens up, and can you have a shock? The shock and the window of vulnerability gives you the recession. Because we have plenty of shocks without recessions. This is the differentiating factor. There's so much, I mean, $7 trillion, right? This is a big number.
Yeah.
Plus, forget about it, I didn't even talk about the Fed stimulus for 2 years before that, which was off the charts. So that's a lot of foam on the runway on a tight labor market. it was virtually impossible to have a recession. But elsewhere we did. Other countries that didn't do that had recessions.
I would suggest that we have a new tilt back to ECRI kind of research within conventional economics. Do you feel as abused now as you were 20 years ago?
Well, look, a lot of money makes things feel good. It covers up things, right? And we've had a lot of debt growth. The right. Really big question is, are the bond market vigilantes going to come back? Are they going to stand for this or not? And that's what we have to see.
Well, come back at 6 standard deviations.
Let's do
five
it.
And a half, 6 and a half. What a joy. Lachlan Achuthan with us. Christian Malek at J.P. Morgan is out of the Imperial College Combine, and he writes brilliantly on oil economics, but particularly the bigger picture, oil macroeconomics. Christian, before the pandemic, you were looking at building demand, particularly across emerging market countries, which would nudge us over $100 a barrel. Maybe the pandemic right. got in the way. Is now the time where we nudge above $100 a barrel?
Yeah, I think you should just sort of unpack that. And hey, Tom, congrats on this fantastic show. A couple of points to make, maybe just before we get to the oil prices. I think we're sort of passing a tipping point, hate to use the cliche, on demand. And I say that because, you know, when you think of statistics like 80% of the world hasn't been on a plane, there is what I call invisible demand, demand that is essentially starting point in the sort of non-OECD world, without wishing to generalize, where vast populations are looking to high grade their living standards to a level that we enjoy here in the West. And so with that in mind, that incremental demand, that incremental dollar of demand for in the context of oil price, that's someone getting on a plane that hasn't been on a plane, or driving a car, or essentially lights on a street that didn't exist, all of that incremental demand is what is compounding to a point where we're seeing very strong growth, well past where we were in the pandemic. And that is the demand growth that's underwriting a much higher oil price in the future. So if you ask the question around $100 right. oil, I think ultimately it's inevitable, particularly given where the supply right. outlook is today.
The events we see, and I don't want to just focus on what we saw at 2 a.m. this morning, U.S. time, right. of Israel and Iran. But the answer is, the experts to me have been surprised by Iranian oil production. It's been good. Mm-hmm. Do I have that right?
The facts say that they're actually producing sort of 5 to 6 year high. And so in that context, it seems correct. I think what we're sort of missing here in sort of talking about Iranian production and other, like, for example, Venezuela, is what is spare capacity in the world? And spare capacity, if you define it as two buckets, one OPEC, the other bucket is shale. You don't tend to think of spare capacity of shale, but it exists. It's the reservoir, it's the oil under the ground. And those two sources of spare capacity are still quite significant. I mean, one we can measure, OPEC, is around 4 to 5 million barrels. The other, shale, well, there's still a very big runway. So combining those two things, and I know I heard your comments earlier about the oil price reaction, we're not surprised. I know that's sort of potentially a surprise to say that, but when you have that much spare capacity in the system, so to speak, you know, any potential move in oil can be met through those additional volumes, be it from Saudi, from OPEC, and ultimately how shale responds to those higher prices.
Christian, my colleague and I, Alex Steele and I, we spent a couple of days at the Bloomberg New Energy Finance Conference here in New York earlier this week. And again, a lot of the industry players coming together and talking about the transition to cleaner energy. From yes. your perspective, where are we on that whole time frame?
Well, it's a timely question because we've come up with a 50-page report that's taken about 9 months to produce. I'd like to say that because sometimes it takes a lot of time to sort of break the back and understanding what is the energy transition of transition? How does it work in terms of the delivery of renewables? And one of the things that we've sort of discovered through the process of re-examining the energy transition is the macroeconomic backdrop has significantly changed. The variables have changed. Interest rates, government debt, cost of living, inflation, a geopolitical landscape that's structurally changed. And so with all those things combined, to then reassess the transition through that lens, what we've sort of unveiled, if you like, is the fact that it's not over, it's still going to continue, but a reality check is needed in terms of its pace, and more importantly, how we use fossil fuels, which we believe are undervalued and underappreciated. So to answer your question directly, the way we see energy transition faring at this point is a sort of re-examination of all the fuels that we can access in order to ensure that we don't have escalating energy prices, because the byproduct of a forced expedited energy transition will be much higher energy prices and pain for the consumer. And that will then, if you think about kind of like the feedback loop, that can end up forcing the hand of governments to do things that aren't appropriate at all, because they're trying to meet the consumer at that point. So we actually think that it's very important to reassess the transition, starting working backwards from the consumer, working backwards from a large part of the world that doesn't have access to energy at all.
That's classic Christian Malick there, Paul. I can't say enough how that changes the EM analysis, the Damien Sassauer world, when he says there, listen to the consumption, listen to the demands, the desires, the aspirations of emerging markets. They're not worried like John Tucker is about can the Rivian find a place to recharge this morning in Summit, New Jersey.
Exactly. Christiane, I mean, we talk about the demand side. On the supply side, why doesn't America, who's now the biggest producer of oil, why don't our shale guys down in Texas and Louisiana just start cranking out more supply?
Great question. I mean, I think one of the things that we've looked at is the productivity and runway of shale production is as follows. When you look at what's under the ground, one of the sort of surprises to the upside on production shale has been lateral drilling, you know, getting basically drilling as far as you can. What's happening now, sort of putting it in layman terms, is we're getting to somebody's house, the fence. You can't drill under their house. You need to now buy your neighbor in order to scale up your production. And that's exactly what's happening through the consolidation. And if you like, consolidation is a sort of red flag in the context of being able to generate higher productivity going forward. And again, in terms, continuing to grow underground. What does this mean? Right. It means that shale production will continue, but it won't continue the same quantums, you know, 1 million barrels a day of growth every year. Right. That's not possible. But I would also flip it around. We need shale production. Shale production is bullish for the economy. Reason being is we need to be able to cap that upside going forward. So having that much Saudi extra production or capacity, having shale, it kind of gives me peace of mind that as much as we're very bullish in the future, oil pricing go to 150, it's important it doesn't overheat. And for that to happen, we need to make sure we have that production. Yeah. So shale is sort of bullish, but counterintuitive, you put it that way.
Christian, we got to leave it there. Thank you, particularly for the analysis of EM demand. Christian Malick, of course, with JP Morgan London on oil.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes. 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Your daily look at the front pages on a Friday. Michael Barr, Lisa Mateo, Paul Sweeney, and I say thank you. Interactive Brokers. Lisa, what do you got?
All right, we're talking about why American roads are so dangerous. This was from the Financial Times. Two things worsen. This is pretty interesting. The total number of miles driven by Americans increased. U.S. cars are getting bigger, right? So Americans are committed to their cars. Actually, 63% of people chose to drive for trips less than a mile. So I guess we're lazy.
We're
tending to drive for those quick trips. Vehicle sizes, larger cars, more deadly to pedestrians. And here's the last interesting point. Another theory is that the rise of homelessness in the U.S. could be pushing pedestrian deaths higher. So those things.
Yeah. So the FT is analyzing our roadways.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, this is John Burns Murdoch. John Burns Murdoch was outstanding in COVID. He's the one that did all the charts everybody stole from, and he stole them from heavyweight academics. I was fascinated, Laura, in that article, Lisa Mateo, about the speed differential between us and Canada. And do you know where I saw mental speed? L.A., I'm sitting there with a cigar in my hand on Sunset Boulevard in L.A., and I'm looking at how people drive in L.A. to go three blocks.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going 45.
Yeah.
We're going 25. I don't get it.
My driver this morning was flying on the turnpike.
They do. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
What do you got next?
All right. Millennials going to golf community. So move over, boomers. The millennials are coming in. Real estate brokers telling the Wall Street Journal that they're tired of paying more for less in the city. A lot of them are turning 40. They like the neighborhood golf feel.
Yep.
Yes. The clubs are catering to this younger crowd. So,
and what do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I
since
mean,
you know the community.
Yeah, our club has been about families since the beginning. But again, I think a lot of folks are relocating. You know, they've left during a pandemic, some of the urban centers, East Coast, West Coast, and going to the Carolinas or Tennessee or Texas or Florida, and those places. They know how to do those golf community things. They're pretty good at it.
You know, there's no one listening now on YouTube who's a worse golfer than me. And I'm sort of, I think I should go out, do Topgolf.
Oh, yeah. You'd have fun.
Do they serve beverages?
They have adult beverages there, and you will have a very good time.
I mean, I'm a good morning Topgolf. I mean, you want to, can we do a package with them?
Sure.
An endorsement?
Sure. Yeah.
Bloomberg
absolutely.
Surveillance brought to you by Topgolf.
We'll do a remote from like Topgolf. Fort Lauderdale.
I love it.
Or Las Vegas.
It's
next.
One of my favorite places. Okay, this is from Consumer Affairs. A survey conducted by Lance Surety Bonds, it found 25% of homeowners who plan to sell their home in the next 12 months plan to do so without a realtor. So that's the interesting thing, that a lot more homeowners are sellers are choosing not to go with the realtor. I've actually seen the signs in the homes around my community, for sale by owner,
right.
A lot more now.
To save on the realtor.
What do you think? Like, what's your take?
There's a lot of paperwork involved.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to take that on. There's a lot of paperwork that I would not want to get wrong.
I don't remember the details, but the fam at one point, a million years ago, I can't remember if they were buying or selling, and it was ugly.
Yeah.
I've always used an agent and just kind of rip it. But I found what the agents didn't get this time when I was selling some homes recently was with the pandemic and the surge in home values, they did not have a good sense of the market. Because the market they'd never seen a market like this. And so they gave me the price. I said tack 20% on top of that. They argued vehemently against it.
And you got it.
I got it 15 minutes before we even put the sign in the ground.
Is 6% dead?
I think so, right? With this new
rule. I don't know. Lisa, I think this was,
we're at 7.1 right now.
No, your mortgage. I'm talking about the fee.
Oh, the fee. You know, the NAR. Yes.
So I don't know. So we'll see. All right.
Okay, thank you. That's newspapers and
but you need this one. You need the next one, Tom.
Oh, yeah. It's a Friday.
Oh, we got one more.
We're talking about you're going to like this
rock group Kiss.
Yes.
Okay, they're voting to get Kiss Corner on 23rd and 8th Avenue in Chelsea.
It works.
Some people want it. Some people don't. I didn't actually realize that's the corner where their Dress to Kill album was, where they took the picture.
Yeah, but you put, they're not going to put up like an obelisk.
It's like a little sign.
Exactly.
But some people don't want it.
No, you listen to me. This is important.
This is Kiss.
Yes, yeah,
I drive home every day, and on the hill of Spanish Harlem, I come down the hill, and there's a little green sign of the people from Puerto Rico that gave their lives in World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's equivalent to Kiss. Now, come on.
Well, on Ludlow Street, guess you're probably one of your favorite bands on Ludlow Street, the Beastie Boys. They have a sign.
Yeah. Lisa Mateo, thank you so much.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast, bringing you the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.